to take another look at this problem of flow through the pipe of a non-interacting Bose gas. And the idea with these things is to look at it from the point of view of the lab frame. Okay, so in the lab, you've got this stuff going through the pipe. So if you Bose condense, this is for N particles. So basically, you condense into a state where every particle has the same momentum, and that's a possible Bose condensed state. Usually, you condense into a state where every particle has momentum zero, but then you don't get any superflow. Or alternatively, you could look at it, if you were in the frame moving with these particles, you would be Bose condensed into a state with zero momentum. Okay, but imagine that you're sitting here in the lab frame and they're all moving with that momentum, and then the energy is equal to sum over I pi squared over 2m, and that turns out to be equal to p squared over 2m n because of the fact that, yeah.
But yesterday you said, I mean, because here you wrote p, the momentum, as like the mechanical momentum, but
this is neutral particles.
Okay.
So this is not superconductivity. Okay.
Okay.
I'm just saying this is just dissipationless flow.
Okay.
Okay. We'll get superconductivity actually in a minute. Okay. So this is this dissipationless superflow neutral. Also, you know, you can also, which is not what I'm talking about, but another good neutral superfluid is helium 3, which is fermions, and is in fact a normal Fermi, normal Fermi limits, which has phases, which are like superconductors, except that it's not charge that's moving. That's just an aside. Okay. So the point is that so you're in this state, and then you consider an excitation. Of one particle, where pi goes to pi plus delta pi. Okay, so just say you take one particle that's moving along and you give it some extra or different momentum. You change its momentum. And then delta E is then just pi plus delta pi squared over 2m minus pi squared over 2m. And so that's equal to, you can write it this way, pi dot delta pi over m plus delta pi squared over 2m. So that's how much you change the energy. And then the point is that this delta pi can be in any direction. And if it's in the opposite direction of pi, then the energy is negative. And so basically, and the walls can do that, absorbing the energy, and you lose momentum delta pi, and you lose energy by this negative quantity. So, you know, same story. So this is just probably this Galilean transformation that I mentioned the last time. So what? Yeah.
For whatever reason, the low energy dispersion was linear.
Yeah, that's nice. Okay, so the question is, so then if you look instead at a weakly And normally what you say is repulsive. If it's attractive, it's totally unstable. So I can't see it. So if you have a weakly repulsive Bose gas, well then what happens? Well, what happens is all these Bose particles bump into each other. And you end up with a dispersion relation. At least for small wave vectors, H bar CK, where C is not your old friend the speed of light, but something which goes like the something like this, 4 pi. This is the scatter length. And this is the density of particles.
Yep. And so why is the attracted Bose gas unstable?
Collapses. Well, I mean, then you have to ask yourself, what do you even mean by attractive Bose gas? I mean, typically it'll form a liquid or a solid or something like that. You sort of have to ask what you mean by the attractive potential, because it can't be purely attractive. It has to eventually somehow be repulsive. Something has to support the density of the thing. So what are you thinking of? Gravitationally contracting photons?
No, I don't know.
So
you said you say repulsive because...
Because that's, attractive, you know, just condenses in some way. Okay, so... Actually, there's a famous line in Lando Lipschitz's staff textbook where they talk about the this is purely hypothetical discussion of weakly interacting gases or Bose gases at low temperatures because all gases condense. Okay, mainly they form solids. So at the time, he wasn't really contemplating EDC, the realization
of photons by condensation.
And you can see right here, the convention for the scattering length is that it's positive for repulsive interactions. And it better be positive because of the square root. So basically, what happens if you turn all these repulsive interactions into Bose gas is that they start to see each other and you get oscillations or sound waves. And so the dispersion relation becomes linear. And if you then take this weakly repulsive Bose gas and Bose condense it in a state which actually corresponds to uniform flow, just like that one, then the excitation spectrum is same thing. What do I want? H bar K dot BS.
So you used Galilean transformation again? I'm just wondering.
Yes and no. You know, whenever I get to this point, I say, okay, let's say that I solve the problem corresponding to an actual superflow. You know, if you solve for the for the ground state and excitation, so for Bose gas that's stationary, you get some compensation energy, and then you get this for the excitation. You can equally well write down the, it's not the ground state, but state that everything's condensed into a single wave vector state, which is moving, just like I said over there. Put in the interactions, calculate the excitation spectrum, and get out this. Okay? But probably there's just some trivial thing that you can write down that says that it has to be this.
But I guess my question was, you get the extra term from
the
going from the moving frame into the pipe frame, right?
Yeah, you're sitting, yeah.
So I'm just wondering if since the dispersion is relativistic, should you Lorentz transport into the
I didn't do it that way.
Okay.
The way I did it, which I didn't write down on the board, I actually solved the problem in the lab frame.
I see.
Of the excitations of the uniformly moving superfluid, the weakly interacting Bose gas. And when you do that and work out what the excitation spectrum is, you get this.
So you get the wrong answer.
You get the right answer.
If you were to Lorentz transport.
I don't know. I never tried. I wouldn't even think about it.
Well, it's a relativistic.
If you consider, so you would say phonons are relativistic particles.
I don't know.
I don't know. That's how relativistic they are. But in any case, but look at this. So basically what this tells you is that for large enough superfluid velocities, if this magnitude of this is larger than the speed of sound, then you can still get negative energy. So there's a critical velocity. That's the critical velocity, is when the superfluid flow, in this very simple picture, where the superflow is at the rate of speed of sound, and once you get there, then you can start spontaneously generating phonons and slowing down. Okay? So that's the way it works. Now, obviously there's a vast literature. Well, on the weakly repulsive Bose gas, there isn't maybe so much experimental work as there is in superfluid helium, which is a liquid. It's not weakly interacting in any sense. Nevertheless, it behaves like a superfluid. It has, as Feynman taught us, an excitation spectrum, which is the Rotron spectrum. That I drew the other day, it looks like this. Well studied, well measured. Okay? The interesting thing, though, is I do have the impression that I think that the situation with regard to the critical velocity is a little bit complicated in superfluid helium 3, and I think it's lower, I believe, that it's lower than you would get from this slope. In fact, it might even be zero, I'm not sure. But anyway, let's not go there. But it is interesting that this idea of what's required for superflow applies to quite a variety of systems. It applies to this system, which is now actually experimentally accessible. It applies to this system, which became accessible in 1908. And it applies to superconductors. Okay, so the bottom line is, for superconductors, just write down the result, that P of K is equal to so this thing here is the electron kinetic energy minus referred to EF. And this thing here is the superconducting gap. So this is the energy of an excitation of a flowing superconductor. If it's not flowing, if E is zero, then the excitation spectrum looks like this. As this function vanishes, there's a gap, delta. For excitations. And you see, that's so much better than these photon-like systems. I mean, this says that there's actually a finite amount of energy required even for arbitrarily long wavelength excitation, or even for the lowest long excitations. There's an actual finite amount of energy, whereas here, it's just the slope. That's finite. Okay? So in any case, that's a property of superconductors, that you have this superflow. One final property that I wanted to mention before we went into the theory, which is also interesting. Is the specific heat film. So let's see. So typically for a superconductor, for piecemeal, yeah, because.
Why do you consider only the kinetic energy of electrons?
What do you mean? Why is this thing
you
here?
You said electron, kinetic energy of electrons, why not like kinetic energy of polar charge particles?
Oh, these would be the. So this is the normal state excitation spectrum referred to the Fermi energy. So you'd be starting out with a system of fermionic fast particles that are the result of this interacting electron soup making your normal Fermi liquid. And then there are some residual attractive interactions which lead to the superconducting instability. This would be the dispersion relation of your fast particle, your normal excitations. That's correct. So, typically for a metal, which actually is dominated at high temperatures by the phonons, a specific heat would look something like this. But what happens if the thing becomes superconducting is more like this. I guess this is the electron. So the point is that you're coming along and the specific heat jumps discontinuously. And then it goes down, and eventually the electronic specific heat goes to zero exponentially. And the exponential part reflects this gap in the excitation spectrum. Okay. The jump in the specific heat is exactly what you expect from mean field theory. If you've ever worked out the specific heat of a mean field phase transition, which if you haven't, maybe you do sometime, it actually gives you a jump in specific heat as the system changes continuously, or as the order below TC arises continuously from zero. The specific heat being some curvature of the free energy actually goes from zero to a non-zero value. Okay? So in a sense, that's really nice that you get this nice mean field jump in the specific heat. But on the other hand, if Marius was here, he would say, yes, but mean field theory, we know mean field theory is wrong. So why do you get something that looks exactly like the predictions of mean field theory? Okay, and in fact, this is something that you probably run into, more than once in your life, where someone will do a measurement and present their data and say, "Wow, it looks exactly like the mean field phase transition." And then you say, "Gee, that's strange. There must be a reason why it should be mean field-like, because most of the time, second-order or continuous phase transitions in three dimensions are not mean field. That's why." Renormalization group was invented. That's why the critical phenomena is a difficult problem. Okay, so then you have to say why. Why is that? And then I might as well, rather than keep you in suspense, just simply say that superconductivity in three-dimensional bulk metals turns out to be a really unusual case where mean field theory actually works, and it's nice because that's the way BCS treated it, and it actually just gave the whole answer. And the reason is that the transition is one in which, every electron, they're not interacting with every other electron, but they're interacting with all the electrons that are within some range of the Fermi energy, which is an infinite number of electrons. And I guess, I don't know how well-versed you guys are in spin systems, but there's sort of a classic problem in classical spins, where you say, imagine I have a Hamiltonian, where so typically what you have in a spin system, like the Ising model, you all know about the Ising model, okay? So in the Ising model, each spin interacts with its neighbors. So it might have four neighbors, or six neighbors, or eight neighbors, whatever you like. But each spin interacts with its nearest neighbors, and then you say, that's all you need to get the phase transition. Okay. But imagine a hypothetical model in which each spin interacts equally with all of its neighbors. Okay, and of course, then the coupling constant has to be reduced by the number of neighbors to make the whole thing scale properly. Everything in the sample, sorry, everything else. So if every spin interacts equally with every other spin. Doesn't even have to be equally, actually, but just say, then you end up with a problem which is exactly solvable, because this guy here is interacting with the sum of all the spins, which is just the total magnetization of the sample. And then, the whole thing turns into something that's trivially solvable, and the answer is exactly what a mean field-like answer that has this jump in the specific heat. Okay, so the superconductivity, just to jump ahead a little bit, has this feature that each electron is interacting with the density of states of electrons at the Fermi energy times the energy gap. So it's interacting with all of those. So anyway, so just to repeat, it is the
the unusual case where the mean, if you like, Hartree-Fock gives a great result for this. Yeah. So, okay, the flow is, okay, so basically the whole liquid or gas or whatever you have is moving with a speed, Vs, with no dissipation, which is why you label it S, because it's superflow.
But like Vs is like a
case. No, Vs is a velocity in real space. It's the velocity of the current in the sample. Exactly. Yes. That's right. So you might, yeah.
Like our energy is about below here.
Yeah, but you see, you've got K here, and you've got K here. So whether this thing is positive or negative depends on the direction and magnitude of Vs. Okay. As long as it's small. As long as it's small, in other words, what basically what this says is that you can have slow or low velocity current flow with no dissipation. If you try to get things to go faster, eventually there will be dissipation, and it will not be dissipation as well. But for small, this parameter can be made arbitrarily. You know, this can be zero or something non-zero in magnitude. So what's, okay, maybe I'm not missing your. Who said it's unbounded from below? How can it be?
Well, I mean,
if you do what?
Very negative.
Yeah, exactly, or positive. If you make Vs large in magnitude, then yeah, that's the point. So superflow, there's the limit. You can have there's a critical velocity above which it's not dissipation, or dissipation occurs. That this is not, this is something, this is something that you just can fix to whatever, if you fix it too large, then the whole thing falls apart. But as long as it's smaller than, in this case, it's a little bit more complicated because you've got this big gap, then superflow occurs. Okay. Anyway, just think about it. Okay, so bottom line, this is not your normal Fermi liquid. The superconducting state is not your normal Fermi liquid. Okay? And it's a little bit like what I said about bosons. Remember, I mentioned deuterium atoms? And how they don't have a fermionic spectrum because they get together and form molecules, and then they're like a Bose liquid. Well, that's a sort of an extreme case that the potential is so strong that they could want to form molecules. The point is that rather like the case of the Bose gas, the Fermi gas itself is also unstable against infinitesimal attractive interaction. Okay, so if you have attractive interaction, then the whole thing that we did that says you fill the states up to the Fermi energy and that's it, it isn't right. Okay, in fact, the attractive interaction mixes up the states near the Fermi energy in a non-perturbative way. Okay, and so that's So one thing you might say is, sure, that's fine, but everybody knows electrons repel each other, so it doesn't matter. Okay, and probably that's true in some materials that don't become superconducting. And so there were sort of two questions in the case of superconductivity. I mean, people could easily imagine, because they knew about the Bose gas, that if you had fermions pairing and becoming bosons, then you could have Bose condensation in some sense. So the idea that attractive interactions might be important was one thing, was something that people were thinking about. So the one question is, what could lead to an attractive interaction between electrons? And then the other question is if you have an attractive interaction between electrons, what do they do? So that's, so both of these questions were answered by Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer. And but it started out with Cooper saying that that it was the no, was that right? Was that the electron-phonon interaction gave rise to attractive? I forget that was. Yeah, it leads to Cooper pairing, but I can't remember. Actually, it's funny. There, in the history of superconductivity, of course, this was like an intensely studied subject because everybody knew that here was an open question that no one knew how to answer, and it was like it was not a subtle thing. It was like a dramatic effect that had been around for over 50 years, or for 50 years, say. And one of the experiments, and of course, countless experiments were done on superconductors. I mean, everything that you could measure was measured. And one of the measurements was the so-called isotope effect, which I also always find to be a rather unsatisfying experiment. But it turns out that if you substitute isotopes of different mass, you know that's what isotopes are. But in your chemical compound in your metal. It actually affects the transition temperature, the temperature at which superconductivity occurs. And so the shift of TC and its relationship to the amount of isotopic substitution that you do is called the isotope effect. And I think there was probably the result was that it goes like the square root of the mass, something like that, TC. And I remember there was a lot of dispute as to whether this was real effect or because I think the results might not have been totally consistent. And so I remember someone saying, gee, his reaction to that was that if this isotope was really true, then it must be the phonons that are doing it. But it took a while for someone to actually work that out. So why? Why do phonons or lattice vibrations or lead to a attractive interaction? Well, if you've got an electron whizzing through your sample, it's got a negative charge. The ions have a tendency to be pulled in towards the region where the electron was. Okay. However, the ions, being very massive, move very slowly. So on the one hand, they don't respond that well. But on the other hand, as the electron goes by and sucks in positive charge, and shoots off, the region of positive, this wake of positive charge persists for a rather long time. And another electron can, say, for instance, be attracted in the wake. Or if you like, electrons with the same but opposite wave vectors, their wave functions sample the region of positive charge that they set up in a way which leads to attraction. Okay, so that's a. So I guess you would call that a hand waving description of the attractive interaction. The point is that the electrons are not at the same place at the same time. Okay, and the effect of polarizing the ionic background persists for a rather long time. So you can see the implications when you actually work out the microscopics, but it's a so-called retarded interaction. It's non-local, so forth. But it's definitely attractive. If it depended on the electrons being in the same place at the same time, then superconductivity wouldn't work at all because there's this big Coulomb interaction that's repulsive. And so they don't like to do that. So if you like, it's these electrons performing some kind of a correlated dance that's taking place over a rather long distance that allows them to sample this interaction, okay? And in fact, leads to this kind of pairing that was first described by Cooper. Okay, so more theoretically, I wasn't going to do anything on phonons, but we'll put in a phonon here. So that's the Hamiltonian of the phonons. They're lattice vibrations. They have some frequency, which is wave vector dependent, and it's also, if you like, polarization dependent or mode dependent, because every atom can vibrate in more than one direction. And not only that, you might have more than one atom in each unit cell, so that you can get complicated motions in which different atoms move in different ways with respect to each other in a unit cell, and they're also described by a wave vector in the Brillouin zone. But anyway, it's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. And the electron-phonon interaction is what do we want here? Some coupling constant. There's different ways of writing this in terms of the phase. But basically that. If you look at the, the transformation from displacements to phonon operators, it involves the sum of B dagger and B, where this is the thing that creates the normal modes.
Can you
say that again, sir?
Can you just explain that? So why is it?
What's this?
Yeah.
This you're fine with, right?
Yeah. That means just the B dagger plus B minus.
Okay, so basically what I've written here says that the electron can create a phonon of wave vector Q. If I got this backwards.
There's something over all Q anyways.
Okay, so the electron comes along, creates a phonon, put it back to Q, and scatters the state K minus Q. Or it's going along, phonon comes along with wave vector minus Q. So it destroys.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Destroys the phonon with minus Q, so it absorbs minus Q.
Yeah, absorbs minus Q. So that's basically it. And then you've got your electron Hamiltonian, which is just electrons in the metal, the fermionic quasi particles that are the result of everything that we did with no functions, with keeping the lattice coefficient. And so the question is, what is the effect of this interaction on the motion of the electrons? And the answer is, there are sort of
two parts to it. On the one hand, the fact that the electron, well, look at it right here. It's moving along and distorting the lattice. That has to affect the way that it moves. Okay? So diagrammatically, you'd say that it's doing something, absorbing and emitting phonons. Okay, and there's some well-defined thing, but basically, I guess we would say that this is a phonon. This is phonon reorganizes the self-energy, which it describes the propagation of the electron in the solid. The fact that the lattice is not linear. Okay? So that's one effect. But the other effect that the phonons can have is that they can mediate an effective interaction between electrons. Okay? So you can have, for instance, electron in state K comes along. It emits a phonon with wave vector minus Q and goes off with, this is what I was thinking when I wrote the Hamiltonian, K plus Q, and then another, let's just focus on the electrons that have equal and opposite momentum. This is just an example. K minus K. And this guy goes off with minus K minus Q. Interestingly enough, it's still K minus K, not surprisingly. Total momentum is conserved. Okay? So that's one thing that can happen in second order perturbation theory. And another thing that can happen is that this guy come along. And generate a phonon. And what happened here? So these are two effective interactions that result in second-order perturbation theory from this fact that electrons can emit or absorb phonons. Yeah.
Sorry, those are just given by the fact that one vertex is lower than the other.
It's later in time. Okay. Yes. Which one is emitting the phonons?
So we shouldn't think of the time magnitude. It's actually sort of like a time.
It's like a time. Yeah.
And then you can increase from one vertex.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Yes and no. Let me just write down the answer, and then I'll tell you. Yeah, I think this is going to be like a portal thing, something like that. The point is that you guys know so much quantum field theory that you should probably be able to derive this in a way which is slicker and neater than I ever could or the old-fashioned people that I studied did. I'm just sort of curious. But anyway, the bottom line is the answer is the effective interaction. The effective of Q is equal to, so this is a coupling constant, G of Q squared. And basically, it's got 1 over epsilon of K plus Q minus epsilon of K plus minus omega Q plus or minus, actually, 1 over epsilon of k plus q minus epsilon of k plus omega of q. And in fact, when you add those up,
What do you get? Omega Q over that. 2 omega Q, actually. Where omega here means epsilon of K plus Q minus epsilon of K. That's the answer. There's a comma there. Okay. Now, what I want to say about this is that if the difference in energy of these two, of this and this, is less than a photon energy, then this is an attractive interaction, because the omega is less than a photon frequency. And if the change in energy of the quasiparticles is greater than a photon energy, then this is a repulsive interaction. Okay? So, are we assuming what? Okay, let's see. What are we assuming here? Okay, so let me just actually step back and do some energy scales here. So the electron energies are of order kF by themselves. They're which is electron volts or tens of thousands of degrees. However, the phase space for scattering is within the range of states that are within kT of the Fermi energy, which is, you know, whatever, dependence on whatever temperature you are. The phonon frequency itself, amazingly, so the phonons have a continuous spectrum, obviously. It starts at zero, typically, well, starts at zero for a solid, and it goes up to some maximum phonon frequency that depends on the spring constant or the stiffness or the compressibility or the transverse, shear restoring forces in the crystal. But there's this model by Debye which says that you can pretend that all phonons have the same frequency, which typically, if you look at the probability distribution or density of states of phonons, turns out to be close to the highest frequency, because the density, there's many more phonons at the top end of the spectrum than there are at the bottom end. A phonon spectrum might look like this. Say, this is density of states. This is omega for phonons. So there's some characteristic Debye frequency which would be out here someplace. That's a number that's on the order of a hundredth of an electron volt, a few hundredths of an electron volt, or like room temperature, okay, a few hundred degrees Kelvin. So that's the phonon frequency. Now this this thing here has to do with how much it changes the potential, the electronic potential, when you distort the lattice. Okay. So what do we want to say about that? M of zero V. It tends to be a small number compared to the Fermi energy. And we will see then that the small parameter in the superconducting problem is, coming back, is essentially the effective interaction times the density of electronic states at the Fermi energy, which goes like 1 over the Fermi energy. And that tends to be a small parameter. But that's putting together a bunch of constants. Okay, so so G, I don't know. I don't have a good feeling for that. But it's going to be something in the milli electron volts range, is my guess. Or maybe a little bit bigger. Okay. So, okay. So that's your attractive interaction. And then I should say that when it comes to calculating anything, there's an even more simplifying assumption. And that is that V effective is minus some number if EK and E of K plus Q what do we call it? Omega divide? And zero otherwise. I actually think that this gets divided by the number of sites because you'll see the way it scales. This is not an energy. This is the Fourier transform of an energy. So it's energy per unit volume. So it actually scales like that, I think. But it's a detail. Yeah, that's like here. It's the frequency where if you replace this continuous spectrum by a single delta function, you get the same thermodynamic functions. That's, of course, impossible, but it's your best attempt at that.
Isn't it my,
you mean doesn't it have something to do with the curvature down here? Yeah.
And the Einstein model was the delta function.
Yeah. That's right. That's sort of a detail. But yeah, it's true. There's sort of these two pictures. One is that you put everything into a delta function at a single energy and calculate the thermodynamic properties. That picture tends to be poor if you go to low temperatures, because it says all of your excitations are up at that frequency. Then there's another. There's another picture due to Debye where you say, okay, but the phonon spectrum is continuous up to some cutoff. And again, it's a single parameter. And in fact, the parameters are pretty much the same. But that gives you the right low temperature properties. Okay, so yeah, that's all true. And that's, you see, I put that in into some arbitrary representative place. So if I wanted to replace this by the Debye spectrum, I'd probably have something that looked like that. I see. Okay, well, we certainly don't have much time for that. Let me just tell you the problem that we're going to do next. Just keep preparing. So Cooper considered the problem where you had a filled Fermi C and you add two electrons. And they interact via an attractive interaction. And the question is, what is the energy of the best wave function that you can calculate for those two electrons? And the answer is that it's an energy, it actually describes a bound state of the two electrons, and that the energy is below twice the Fermi energy. And so it actually doesn't make sense. It doesn't, but it says it actually, what it does is it points to an instability of the fermions under the influence of this attractive interaction. So, so we'll take a look at that. It's a useful calculation to look at because it shows you how the parameters go together that describe the theory. And then after that, you want to do the real problem of n electrons with an attractive interaction, which is what BCS did. Okay, so tomorrow, if there's not too much of a blizzard, I'll be here and we'll do that. If not, I don't know, Dennis will lecture to you. Okay. What's that? Oh, I'm worried because it's actually starting in the middle of the night, because that's so that's like the worst.
No. It will not because the forecast only 1 centimeter of snow.
Well, if it's that, then we're fine. Is that in Waterloo? Yeah, okay. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, but it's true in the future.
Yeah, predicting the weather. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
How come phonons are both? Like, how do we. Why? I suppose it's the same question as, like.